Let me begin by saying, as I do every year, that I haven't figured out what I'm supposed to be doing here yet. If you really need me to teach you how to be Masadur Kiddushin, I strongly suggest that you switch to Sai Sim's School of Business. But what I'll do is try to talk about things that arise with regard to Seder Kiddushin in one form or another. And before beginning, I draw your attention to the material on page number one, which is nothing more than... Wrong page. It's not page number one, it's page number four, which is nothing more than a bibliography. And there, it's arranged under different title headings. I just want to say a brief word or two about some of them. The first, to which I call Klolli or Encyclopedic Works, dealing with Shailos of Halacha on the order of Ebenezer. The second are simply Kitzurim. Those are essentially modern-day sources, and they're very valuable. It doesn't necessarily mean that you should have every one of them, but you certainly ought to have some of them in your library, particularly the Inve HaGefen and the Nesuim Kihochosom, which I find to be very valuable. And then there are a series dealing with the Ksuba itself, in particular the Tosefes Ksuba, written by Yehuda Kellerman, is a word-by-word explanation of the Ksuba, and I'm not going to take time to go through it, but there are things that, if you don't know, could be rather embarrassing, and it's certainly worthwhile to go through this material. Including, among other things, he will give you sources with regard to the value of Ksuba in Troy silver ounces. Doesn't help you translate into dollars because you have to look at the morning's London fixing as reported in the New York Times. But it's interesting and it's a peripheral issue. I'm not going to talk about it. Sheva Brochas we don't cover at all. But the Sevas Moches of Rav Teplitzky is extremely important, particularly when you're dealing with a non-normal situation, in quotation marks, meaning that you're dealing with what is ostensibly a first marriage, but not necessarily the first sexual liaison. And then there's this very interesting sefer of Yochim Ellenson dealing with Nisuyin, Shaloi Kedas Moshe of Yisrael, which he dedicates to his wife, who he says he married Kedas Moshe of Yisrael. And then a source that you should be aware of, and that's the Shemos HaYoris, particularly if you're not going to be in the metropolitan area. There are some places that are already muchzak for Ksivas, Gittin, and Ksubas, and we'll talk more about the problems involved a little bit later, but the places that are muchzak in this country are included in Rabbi Sandorovitz's compendium, as well as, I didn't put on the list, there are a couple of pages in Matseves Pinchos, written by Rabbi Bach in Baltimore, dealing with also a number of such cities. And then finally, the only thing that you really need to be Masadur Kiddushin, you don't need a rabbi's guide. All you need is a Kitzer Nachle Shiva. It has first the text of Birkas Erisin, Birkas Nisuin. B, it will tell you how to fill out the dates and the years, etc., etc. And it will also give you some of the Nisrois. I believe I have there reprinted in the end, like Eksuba de Irkasa. But there are all kinds of nuschois that are significant, and you'll find them there. Okay, having said all of that, let me try to go through the material sequentially in terms of the syllabus that's here someplace or other. You have, yes, that's on page one, beginning with Shiduchim. Now, let me make a number of points with regard to Shiduchim, Tnoim, etc., etc. There is a feeling in some circles. Let me start even before the shidduchim. Let me start with something that you ought to be aware of. It's just as a matter of curiosity, if nothing else. I don't think I included any of the material here, but Rav Henkin Zecharon Livracha was concerned that if a chosen gives the kala an engagement ring publicly at an engagement party, it may have aloch of savlonis and may require a get afterwards. Now, you probably are unaware of the institutionalized engagement parties that once existed in this country. I know it only from hearsay. But if you read the biography of Mordechai Kaplan by Gruach and Schechter, you will find, among other things, a kind of a sociological vignette dealing with these huge catered engagement parties. He presents it in terms of the American rabbinate and says some things that if you go bother looking at, you'll discover for yourselves. If not, nothing important there. But this is the kind of thing that Rav Henkin was talking about, and he was concerned that if you do these things in public, it may have the status of kedushin and require a get afterwards. That's just nothing more than curiosity. My impression is that all of this has fallen into disuse, and even if there is an engagement party, it would be considered a little bit gross for the groom to present an engagement ring to the bride in public. In any event, let's go now to shidduchim. Shidduchim, some people think that the Ksivas HaTanoim is a sine qua non. It's absolutely mandated by Halacha. And their citation will be Rav Mangi Daman Dekodesh Voloi Shidduchim. It's one of the three things that Rav pronounced a klola. If somebody is Mekadesh without prior Shidduchim, and therefore they presume that this is the origin of Tanoim, and therefore they seem to think that it's absolutely necessary to have Tanoim before the Chuppah. Now, let me first talk a little bit about Rav Mangid, and then about whether it's really necessary, and three, whether we haven't created problems at the same time. Rav Mangid Aman Dekodesh Bolo Shidduchi is nothing other than what is colloquially known as the drunken sailor syndrome. Those of you who are married may remember that when you got a marriage license, instead of telling you how long it's valid, it does. It tells you in New York, I think it's valid for 60 days. It also says that it's not valid for 24 hours after, for the first 24 hours after the license has been issued, and it's stamped not with a date, but with a clock. You can't get married within 24 hours, so don't count on getting the license the last minute on the day of the chasana. The reason for this is that the city fathers, who had no idea of Rav Mangid, but in their wisdom, they were mechaven to exactly the same thing. He was afraid that somebody would enter into a precipitous marriage and regret it afterwards. In our society, it ended up not only in regrets afterwards, but abandonment, and you had women who were then left seeking ways and means of having the marriage annulled or terminated by divorce, etc., etc. Now, is that really necessary in terms of halacha? Sure, you need shidduchim. Question is, what are shidduchim? Nowhere do I know of a source that says that the shidduchim have to be in writing. It seems to me that if you're having a catered wedding, I'm not quite sure why we have catered weddings, but Yasudas Eris and Susan Sweet I know all about, but extravaganza, I don't really know where it comes from. But if somebody had to decide to sign a contract with the caterer, and either the chosen does it because he's the one who's mechuyev mitzad adin to defray the cost of the suvus eris and suvus nesuin, or the bride's father has signed the contract. Either way, there's been some kind of negotiation with regard to what kind of a wedding we're going to have and who's going to pay for it. That sounds to me very much like shiduchim. And I won't even ask about whether they've already rented an apartment, because if you've done that, somebody had to sign the lease. And when you're signing a lease on behalf of two parties, it sounds to me, again, as if it's shiduche. Not to speak of the agreement with regard to who's going to buy the furniture, etc., etc. So what is this all about, and why do people insist on the tnoim? They presumably insist on the written tnoim because they believe, maybe even correctly, that you can't be Yetzirah Mangid unless you have a written instrument. On the other hand, writing tnoim presents a problem, particularly in our day and age. Remember also that in days gone by, tnoim were necessary for a very simple reason, and that is because the young couple were in no position to support themselves. They may still not be in a position to support themselves, but instead of working it out in one way or another, the mechutonim agreed with regard to support and maintenance for a period of time, or with regard to a dowry that was to be used in setting up the young man in some kind of business, because that's how you earned a living once upon a time. So that there was good reason for having all of this in writing. Those reasons seem to have fallen by the wayside, and even there would be good reason for it, I have never seen a tnoim that contained anything of consequence. It's all one size fits all. No statements with regard to who's going to pay for what, or how much the natan is going to be, etc., etc. But the minhag, if I can call it that, remains very, very firm. Now, what's the downside of all of this? There are two downsides. The first downside is that the Gro maintained that there is no such thing as a breakup of a shidduch after you've written the tnoim without triggering the cherem that is mentioned in the tnoim, which itself is shrouded in obscurity. The standard text of tnoim, which I think you have in the back of the package, provides for both a knas and for a cherem. Knas we're not going to talk about. The Balei HaTosfos and the Chachmei Sforad, cited by the Rambam, both had trouble with regard to the enforcement because it's a knas, but they said whatever they had to say about it. And then there's the cherem for breach of promise. Breach of promise in common law was a tort and was still actionable in New York until sometime in the 1930s. And here you have a knas for not going through with the marriage. Knas plus a cherem for not going through with a marriage. Where does this cherem come from? I haven't the vaguest idea. There is a tshuva nechsam sefer dealing with the cherem that if you go to the library, you will see on the sharblat of any sefer printed in the 17th or 18th and into the 19th century, a cherem against violation of copyright in effect. Nechsam Sefer says he hasn't the vaguest idea where this cherem comes from. It must be a cherem hakadmeinim, just as the cherem with regard to shiduchim. And you know, my response is arvach arvach tzorech. And what's so simple about this cherem with regard to bitul shiduchim? But in any event, the text of the cherem is there. Whether the cherem with regard to copyright has any connection or not, I'm not going to try to explore. Remember, the Chassam Sefer is writing in the earlier part of the 19th century, and Herr Gutenberg invented the printing press sometime in the mid 15th century. How long ago was it for the Cherem and the source to have been forgotten? Mela, the Cherem of Shiduchim could go back, for all I know, to the Kufas HaMishnah, or at least the Kufas HaMeroim. But that's neither here nor there. The Cherem is there, and the Groa takes it very, very seriously, maintaining that there's no Mechila. You cannot break the Tanoim even with mutual consent, and unless one Kuli has, if there's Kefin Lagarish, then you can violate the Cherem also, because there's no Cherem if otherwise there would be Kfi on the Gerishin. But otherwise the Groa had only one Eitzah: get married and divorced. So the Mizbeach is married the Mois if you divorce your first wife, but that's far less onerous than the Cherem. So the Cherem has more, I'm sorry, the Tanoim have more or less fallen into disuse in the contemporary age. Number one, because not so terribly important sociologically, financially, or what have you. And number two, unfortunately, incidents of broken engagements have risen in this country, and people were afraid, if they still remember why they still write tonight, now nobody remembers anything anymore, but it fell into disuse in, among circles that knew what they were doing, because of a fear that there would be a broken engagement and you'd be stuck with a scherim. The problem, if you need problems within problems, Rav Moshe maintains that there's the same cherem with or without a written instrument, that wherever you have what he defines as shiduchim, and how we have to define it is a separate issue, but he thinks that there's the same cherem with regard to bittul of shiduchim. So the practice then becomes to write tnoim, but to write it immediately before the chuppah, when you're not afraid anymore that the result will be a broken engagement. Why not let people have their chumrah if they want it? What harm can you have if you have the if you have the tnoim right before the chuppah? There's only one problem, and that's the Chamudei Daniel, which is, you can find it in the materials. The Chamudei Daniel cited by the Pesachei Tshuva maintains that wherever there is tnoim, you require shiva nikim after the tnoim. He considers the tnoim to be a tovua linose. Now, I don't really know pshat in the Chamudei Daniel, or better, there can be two separate pshotim in the Chamudei Daniel. One could be that the Chamudei Daniel maintained that this is formalistic, that Tavuli Nosei Tzir Chaleshi Zayin Nikim is a Takonas Chazal, and now Tnoim is by definition a Tavuli Nosei. There may have been an earlier Tzir, but the Chamudei Daniel is talking cases where there is first a Tzir, one proposal, and then for whatever reason a second proposal. So the Tnoim, they maintain, constitutes a Tavuli Nosei, and it triggers the Takon of Zayin Nikim. I don't like repeating things in the names of people when I have not heard it from them orally, or if it's not in writing, particularly since my source is Reb Yankov Kamenetsky, Zochrono Livracha, who once had occasion to tell me, when I had a lengthy conversation with him in which I took issue with something that had been said in his name, and after listening to me patiently, responded by nu. And I said, well, what do you mean nu? The Rosh Hashiva said the opposite. And he told me, in Yiddish, he says, Reb David, ich sag euch in Yisold Gedenken, Yisold Gornish nish leben, was man sagt in mein Namen, seid ne hertes von mich allein. He said, don't believe a word that they say in my name unless you heard it from me. But one of the things that they say in his name is that when he was Masada Kedushin and the couple, quote, insisted, close quote, upon Tnoim right before the Chuppah. He insisted on being one of the Edim on the Tnoim and managed to passel his signature. Which, if true, I understand. If true, I understand the shir. And what he's saying, is the Chumuri Daniel is nothing more than a triggering a takone. If it's triggering a takone, then if I don't have valid noim, I didn't trigger the takone. So let these people do whatever they want, and there won't be a problem with the Chumuri Daniel. I, however, don't think that's what the Chumuri Daniel meant. And that may be because European Rosh Yeshiva didn't have the same experience that that we have. And that is that the incidents, barring taking the pill, which I'll talk about in a moment, if you allow things to be governed by nature, a majority of all chuppahs turn out to be a chuppahs nida. Now, I don't have a sociological survey, but you get enough anecdotal evidence to realize this. And if you want to know why, the answer is really very simple. And that is that young ladies, despite the best laid plans of kallahs, who try to figure out, based upon the previous menses, when is a safe date for the chuppah, end up having a chuppas nida, and that's because the menses are controlled by hormones. I hear tell that the period between engagement and marriage is stressful, and you don't have to be an endocrinologist to know that that wreaks havoc with the endocrine system, and hence the hormones are all out of balance, and the result is that you can't predict. Now, I think the Chazal were describing something of that nature. I even gave it a name. I call it kalaitis. Don't try to find it in the medical literature, but that's what I call the fact that young ladies who have been regular for years suddenly become irregular after engagement. It's all because of the stress and the hormones, etc., etc. And I do believe that Chazal sometimes had a much firmer grip on science than we do, and I suspect that this is part, if not entirely, the reason for Rav Mangid, for Tavu Elinose. I mean, it put in so many words, Rechishish for Dam Chimud. What in the world do you think Dam Chimud is? Dam Chimud doesn't have to be precisely that minute. The Tavu Elinose creates an emotional reaction, and that results in Dam Chimud, which requires Shiva Nekim. Now, I have a solution, if anyone's interested in it, and that is a way to have your chumrah without it being a chumrah d'osav d'kula. And that is to have the tnoim, but heaven forfend, don't tell the kala about it. The kala doesn't have to be present. You can have the opportunity for two more kibudim, two more Edim on the Ksuba, and a photo op, the mothers of the Kala and the Chosen can come and break a plate, and everybody will be happy. The Tavula Nose is only if this is directly with the Kala. And particularly if you have a knowledgeable Kala who knows all about the Cherem and the Gruel, etc., etc., and often they know more than the Chasanim about these things, if she's there, I understand the Dam Chimud, and it's not simply formalistic. Now it's serious. Till now it wasn't serious. However, she's not present, there's no Tavul and Naseh, and there's nothing that would fall within the Tavul and Naseh, which requires Shiva Nikim. I'm also convinced that Ramesha was understood Pshat in the Chumuri Daniel the way I do, because if you look at his Nusach, you'll see that it doesn't provide for the presence of a Kala. All of the earlier in the Nusachos, the ones that you'll find in the Sforim stores, the ones you'll find in Nachla Shiva, have provision for the signature of the chosen and kala plus the aiding. Why the chosen and kala is a separate issue. I'm not talking. We're not worried about that right now. But I'm convinced that that was the consideration that led Ramesha to draft a text that A, made sense, and B, did not provide for the presence of the kala at all. The other little point that I should make is, and this is again, the only reason I'm saying it is because I have my problems in halacha, but there are also medical problems. I understand that there are people who are prescribing a pill, and I use the word prescribe. The ones who are giving the pills without a prescription, there ought to be a chayrim against doing things like that. The pill is not innocuous, and no person ought to be taking the pill without a medical consultation. It can be contraindicated and can be dangerous in some conditions. Granted, they're few and far between, but you do not engage in self-medication. And even if a doctor is willing to prescribe the pill, and after all, he has no reason not to prescribe the pill, or at least no obvious reason not to prescribe the pill, he ought to be consulted with regard to the possibility of congenital defects to children who are born within a short time after women go off the pill. If nothing else, it should prompt him to read the literature. I take no stand with regard to the medical choices. Some people dismiss them, and other people say that they should not be dismissed. In any person who is on the pill for a significant period of time is told not to become pregnant within 3 months after ceasing taking the pill. Where there's the same shash if you've been on it just for a couple of months instead of a matter of years, I leave to people who should know a lot more about it than I do. But I can't dismiss that. What does concern me is that Rav Moshe has it b'ksav, and he's absolutely right, that if you're on the pill, there is always the problem of intramenstrual spotting. And my first problem was, how in the world can a psula make the proper bedikis if what you're concerned about is not a normal menstrual flow, but a rather insignificant amount of dam, which Chazal called dam chimud. Rav Moshe himself, when I presented this problem to him, shrugged his shoulders and said he's got other problems. His problem was determining the vestis. What is the status of the pill? Is it mevatel the previous vest? Is it not mevatel the previous vest? Do you have to be kivei a new vestis in accordance with the pill to use again his Yiddish expression, mekenish degena talk mit the vestis? You can't figure out how to do the vestis properly. That's, you know, my hesitation with regard to use of the pill. I suppose in theory you could be cheshish for every conceivable vest and work it out carefully or whatever. But the problem is there just as a problem. You have to deal with the issues as they arise, whereas the issue of chupas nida or any other issue that can arise. So much for the tnoim, etc. Problem is, and who's now going to get engaged? So one of the topics which are under discussion is item Bays on page 1, and that is the problem of Kala v'chamaisa, chosen v'chosnai. People who are not concerned about much more important things suddenly become terribly concerned when the Kala's name is the same as the chosen's mother, or the chosen is the same as the father-in-law, and they have all kinds of problems. So first, let me talk about whether there's really a problem in the first place in terms of the technicalities, and then whether you really ought to be making problems when there are no problems, or does this constitute making problems where there are no problems? Number one, there's this Chuv Nechsam Sofer on page 52, with regard at least the Chosn and the father-in-law. He says that the problem is only if they are Mishuloshim. It goes down to the next generation. You have a grandfather, a son-in-law, and a grandson-in-law, all of whom have the same name. Less than that, he's not concerned about. The question is, and if so, what difference does it possibly make? Why in the world is there this problem of Kala v'Chamisa and what have you? In the citation of the Eitzar Peskin on page 165, you will find citation of some people who say it's some kind of Ayin Hara. Please don't ask me to explain that any further. But if there is a kind of Ayin Hara, then supposedly it's triggered by this. I don't know why Kala v'chamaisa should trigger it more than Chosn v'chaisnai, and we have much stronger earlier sources for Kala v'chamaisa than Chosn v'chaisnai. The two reasons that are really given, basically it comes from the Tzavor Yehuda HaChosid, that this was Al-Pi-Kabola, he realized that there was some kind of a danger, one danger or another. I'll return to that in a moment, but the second is a chashash in halacha, the problem of addressing a spouse with the name of your own parent in the parent's presence, or even not in the presence of a parent, if it's a Shem Peli. That's one chashash in halacha. The other chashash in halacha is, particularly before electricity, there wasn't terribly much light around at night, and the fear that Tvias Eino Dekola may not be universal, and in the middle of the night you can call for a spouse, and instead of a spouse showing up, an in-law will show up, and nothing more need be said. But all of those are reasons which are given in the Peskin. Now, the ways to get around it, or is there a way to get around it? Number one, when there are two names and only one is the same, it seems to me that it doesn't even begin to be a Shaila, and that's for a very simple reason. I know absolutely nothing about Kabbalah, but I hear tell, and I have seen in sources, that in terms of Kabbalah, if you give somebody two names, you call them Avram Yankiv, you haven't given two names, you've given only one name. The two names become one name for all intents and purposes, that I've seen discussed essentially with regard to naming after people who have deceased, and you try to name after two people, these sources say you've defeated the purpose, you've given a name after nobody. They ignore the fact that, forget about the Kabbalah, this may help Sholem Bayis and make people feel happy. So, if it makes them feel happy, very good. But if you're dealing with problems of Kal v'Chameis, etc., wherever there are two names and the name of the other one is not replicated in both names, there's no problem whatsoever. There are sources that indicate that if there is a Shem Laz, there's no problem whatsoever, because a Shem Laz is also a name. It's not the Shem Arisa, but it has the status of a name, and for whatever reason, if there is a Shem Laz in addition to the Shem Kodesh, you're not mechuyiv to be concerned beyond that. There is one little anecdote that I will tell you, but I will also draw your attention to the material in the Eitzar HaPay scheme, in which cites one source and says that if the father-in-law's name is Rav Shmuel and the son-in-law's name is Shmuel, those are a different name. Rav Shmuel isn't the same as Shmuel. There's no further problem. The little anecdote deals with a match between two Hasidic rebbes, and apparently they hadn't met, and certainly the Chosn Kala hadn't met until they came time to write to Noyim. So the Shatkin has arranged everything, and they come for the Lachaim and for the Noyim. It suddenly occurs to them to ask the names of the Chosn and Kala. And it turns out that the name of the Kala was the same as the mother-in-law. And the father of the Kala was very upset. The father of the Chosn was very upset. The father of the Kala turns to his would-be Mechutin and says, "Very nice, you told me her name." He wants to know, "What do they call her? What's the name that she goes by?" And he looks at him and says, "Everybody calls her Ebbetson." So clap on the table, says Mazel Tov, the names are different, and proceeds to say that if you call her Rebbetzin, it's like a Shem Laz, and there's no further problem with regard to the names. Now, let me just draw your attention first to whether it's a problem in the first place, and then to at least one of the solutions to the problem that I advise against. And here you have a tshuva of Noyim Yehudit. It's on page 81. It's important way beyond the subject matter of the tshuva of Noyim Yehudit. He was asked by a Talmud or a former Talmud, whether it was his sister apparently, wanted to marry somebody, and there was the same problem with regard to the names. The name was the same. It's actually page, yes, 81. And he responds by telling him in the first paragraph of Siman Ayin Tes that Lule Vosacha Ein Darki Lohoshi Minyonik Eilu Dvorim Shein Lohen Sheirish B'Talmud Ube Paiskim. Matters of Kabbalah, he doesn't answer. There's no Mokra in Halacha. But since you insist, I'll answer you. So he says that one thing he should remember, and it should be chukukim al-libucho, that anybody who says something connected the Gemara, he's in pretty bad shape. He says, "Ein l'chol chachom shachar Talmud rishus loymar dover neged haTalmud v'imer dover lister kutze yud midivrei haTalmud leichoshev bichlal chachme Yisrael." But then he says, "You find somebody who's muchzak b'teirin Yerushimayim who says something neged the Gemara, so you have to find a way of explaining what he means." And he proceeds to cite 3, 4, 5 different statements in the Tzavor of Yehuda HaChosid that are contradicted by Gemaras. He says, "How can it be?" To which he responds that next paragraph, "Ve'emes Yeridarkei," that Rabbi Yehuda HaChosid was writing only for his progeny, his descendants, that he realized Baruch HaKadosh that some of these shiduchim will not be Eliyofa, and therefore advised them against the shidduch altogether. And incidentally, again, the Eser HaPeskim, you'll find something attributed to the Marsho. Apparently in one of the fairs, when you read that took place where Chachmei Yisrael gathered for Inyonim of the Kehillah as well, the issue of the Tzavor of Rabbi Yehuda HaChosid was on the table, and the suggestion was made that it was only Lazaroi, and the Marsho gets up and says that the Tzavor says you shouldn't marry somebody whose name is Yehuda, and you shouldn't marry somebody whose name is Shmuel. Said he, "My name is Shmuel, and my father's name was Yehuda, and we are descendants of Rabbi Yehuda HaChosid." So the Marsho wasn't very much concerned with the Tzavor of Rabbi Yehuda HaChosid at all. The Noyim Yehuda said it was only intended for progeny, but wasn't intended for anybody else. But if you look at the last couple of lines, he says, "Vaday lechomer tzavos achosid mivome l'shuk," and this can't suddenly, you can't be involved in the case in which you will be Mishan Hashem, it'll turn out to be the Shem of the mother-in-law, the father-in-law, and now suddenly the Zivug should be Osir, Drachea Darchi Noyam, once she's Muteris Lashuk, she can't suddenly become Osir. And he proceeds to say one little point, namely that it can't apply to any name which is given afterwards. It can only be the name that is given at the time of the bris or time of birth, and anything else doesn't count. Any other names are lebroche, the loy, leklolo. And then finally, the makeh bepatish, umilvad kol zelvi mechtovcha, reitza chesnach lischateim, im tzur v'mirabonon v'shemer mitzvahu. Utmahani al roi v'ilom, shalosis bitum lamoretz uposhut etzlom. Ben choishish lehimona, who negedivri chazal shomru, kil kisam in ichalit neari, uli schatin in survo mirabonon, sheshmoi kishmoi him shayolin, vloidehe terish lehimish alonu kitsavo bealma. So says the Nadi Behuda, if the Hassan is a Talmud Chacham, forget about all of this. It's more significant than any other consideration. All right, enough for why I don't really consider the problem to be a problem in the first place. But there are people who want to solve the problem. And how do you solve the problem? They would like to add a name, change the name. Who knows what, particularly among Chassidim, this is a kind of a standard remedy. The Igros Moshe, Rav Moshe, in one of the tshuvas, I think it's in your package, opposes it and opposes it vehemently. He opposes it because he's afraid that the new name will not become muchzak by the time you go to write the ksuba. And of course, you're not going to use the original name. You're going to use the new name in the ksuba, and you end up with a ksuba, which is possible, and you've got real problems of halacha. I'm even more concerned than Rav Moshe, and I'll talk about this a little bit later when we talk about a Shemas La'az. I'm afraid of situations in which, mainly if you're doing it to satisfy some grandmother, and after the chasna everybody's going to forget about it, and oilum k'min hogenoi, you're going to call the chosn or the chala by whatever name you used before, and you are machzik it even for lamed yoim. If you'll forget about it afterwards, and cholil, you go to write again, it'll be nishtakach. I'm afraid that there will be vague, dim memories of all of this, that it may be used on occasion, not used on another occasion, and then you confront the poor Mesater Haget with the problem of whether he should use the new name, not use the new name, and maybe whether he even has to write two separate Gittin, which has its own series of problems. Life is complicated enough. I don't know why you have to create shailus in halacha so that then people should be afterwards concerned with things that can be of far greater import than something like kala v'chamaisa. So I strongly advise against changing names, adding names, in order to avoid the problem. But that's the material. The material's there for you to look at, etc., etc. Now, we're now at the chuppah, and among other things, we have to be concerned with the writing of the ksuba. So the first thing is to talk just a little bit about the name of the cities. Now, cities are problematic for a number of reasons, particularly since we live in the diaspora, and the cities have names that have no relationship with Loshon Kodesh. There are principles here that you have to be aware of, particularly if you're living in a place that hasn't become muchzak for ksubas. And which is becoming more and more common. People are moving to the suburbs, new places, and you have a new shul in the suburb, and this is the first time anybody's written a ksuba, and the question is how to write a ksuba. The general rule is that you transliterate the vernacular, and you'll have to know how to transliterate the vernacular, and that will come to just a little bit later. But where the place is already muhzak, nobody is concerned with what people, how people refer to the city or how they don't refer to the city. The way it was muhzak remains the way it's muhzak. I gave you, I don't remember how many examples I gave you. I remember I gave you New York from Beis Medrash Shen Ve'ever, which is an obscure kind of collection. Somebody went around all over the world collecting Gittin and recording how cities were spelled in the Gittin. But my favorite paradigm is No Amon. Does anybody know where No Amon is on planet Earth? No Amon is Alexandria. The only place you're going to hear or see about Noamon if you go to the library and find a sefer that was printed in the 16th or 1700s on the Shar blot, it'll say Noamon. It is now known as Alexandria in the English-speaking world. I don't know what they call it in Egyptian. I'm sure it's not Noamon, whatever it is. Yet, Gittin that were written in Noamon, and there's still a handful of Jews in Noamon, they're not writing Gittin, but until 48, there was a huge, tremendous community in Noamon, in Alexandria. It was near the Ein Yisrael. The Gittin were written in Noamon. That was how it was muhzak among Jews. In Amsterdam, it was just a little bit more complicated. The city was originally Amsterdam, and there are Gittin that still contain Amsterdam, usually with Niscaria Amsterdam. They, for whatever reason, put in both names. There are exceptions to this general rule. There was a certain city that was known among Jews as Petersburg, and I'm sure you can identify it. It's St. Petersburg. They didn't call it St. Petersburg or whatever you call the saint in Russian. They called it Petersburg. They did write Gittin called Petersburg and continued to write it when it was Leningrad. At some time when it, I'm sorry, no, it was called Petrograd. At some time when it became known as Leningrad, they stopped writing Petersburg and began writing Leningrad. And that was because the Malchus Makpedes, the non-Jews, got upset if you used the old name of St. Petersburg. I suspect that now they're extent that they're being Masadr Gittin, they probably are still calling, writing it as Petersburg. No reason not to. The non-Jews are calling it Petersburg or its equivalent, and among Jews it was always known as Petersburg. The other example is another city that you may or may not recognize. It's called Kushta. Where's Kushta? Kushta's Constantinople. Constantinople is no longer Constantinople. What is Constantinople today?
Istanbul.
It's Istanbul. I had a kind of minorly unforgettable experience of participating in a conference in Istanbul not all that long ago, and the chairman of the conference came up to every rabbinic speaker, whispered into his ear before he got up to speak that we know that rabbinic scholars refer to the city as Constantinople. Please try to be careful. And if you have to talk about the city, it's Istanbul. The government doesn't like our using Constantinople. Remember that the Greeks and the Turks were bosom enemies, and Constantinople, Kushta, was a Greek name, not a Turkish name. And lo and behold, a get came my way sometime afterwards, which I wouldn't have understood had I not known about all of this. I didn't realize the Malchus was Makbid. Guess what? It said Istanbul. It didn't say Kushta. It was clear because the Malchus was Makbid. So the first principle is the place that is Muchzak, the name which it was Muchzak is the name which is used, and even it was spelled incorrectly, and I'll give you a few examples in a moment. The way that it was Muchzak L'Ksivas Gitin is the one that prevails. Now, there are places even closer to home where we use what was Muchzak and not what it is today. The other side of the bridge or the bridges, there's a place that they tell me is called Brooklyn. There is no city called Brooklyn. Brooklyn is a borough of the city of New York. As such, you would not write it in a get or in a ksuba. It's like a shuna. You do not write the names of neighborhoods. We do, however, write Brooklyn. And why do we write Brooklyn? Because when was it, 1898, that New York became an amalgamation of five different boroughs, and they were writing Gitin in Brooklyn before then, so it was Muchzak, L'Ksivas, Gitin, and Ksubas as Brooklyn, and it remains Brooklyn. By the way, maybe I'll talk about it later, if not, there you do not write Brooklyn, New York. I cringe every time I hear it, but there is no city on planet Earth called Brooklyn, New York. There is Brooklyn in the state of New York. And if somebody were to write Brooklyn in Medinas, New York, I'd shrug my shoulders and say he doesn't know that we don't write the Shem HaMedina for reasons we'll talk about later. But it's one thing to write something superfluously, and it's something else to write it incorrectly. Brooklyn, New York is plain incorrect. And please don't cite all the Rosh Yeshiva who you heard being Masader Iksuba writing Brooklyn, New York. It's elementary. They just presumably haven't had experience with Seamus Gittin or whatever. The Shem HaMedina is always omitted where there is a place that was Muchzak. You continue to write that which was Muchzak. Now, this has other ramifications as well. There are places that don't have a city altogether, and what do you do when you don't have a city? The Aruch HaShulchan, which I've also given you, I think it's, where is it? I don't remember what page it is anymore. It's someplace in the back. The Aruch HaShulchan talks about how to write Nevardok and proceeds to tell us that there, number one, he had problems with the spelling of Nevardok, and he was hesitant to be Mesader Gitin at all because he disagreed with his predecessors, but he managed to resolve that problem to his satisfaction. But then it's on page 148, Ois Yudches. He talks about writing Gitin Bebote HaChatzeres Al HaSodeis. He's writing about Yeshuvnikis, people who lived out in the villages. Now remember, this is Poland, Russia, Lithuania. One of the Jewish sources of livelihood was to run what was called, I suppose it must be Russian, or maybe it's Polish, a kretschma. He writes it as a kretschem. In my Yiddish, they called it a kretschma. A kretschma, the closest counterpart, is a British pub. A British pub serves liquor, serves some food also, pub food, as it's called. And usually, there are a couple of rooms upstairs which the proprietor, the publican, as he is known, rents out to people. Now, these things existed on the roads, and Jews ran them. They ran them because they had the monopoly of the local feudal lord that gave them the right to sell the liquor, and this is what you did. You set up this little business, and every one of these places had a name. Russian, Poland, I know nothing about. But if you've been to England, you will see that every pub has a crest, has a coat of arms, and it's got a name. In particular, If you go to Oxford, you will find behind the Bodleian, there's a pub in which if you have an IQ of less than 150, they'll probably throw you out. That's where it's frequented by the faculty of Harvard. It's called the King's Arms. And you make appointments, because there are lots of pubs around. You tell all your friends to meet you at such and such a time at the King's Arms. Now this is what the Aruch HaShulchan is talking about. You had these kretschmas, and each one had its own name. And if you're Mesader a get in a kretschma, I didn't know the Aruch HaShulchan, I would have said, Bekretschma, King's Arms, and maybe I would have identified it further, maybe I wouldn't identify it further. The Aruch HaShulchan has a problem, because he seems to think that there is no Hebrew or Aramaic equivalent for a kretschma. I don't know why you can't call it an achsanya, but he seemed to think that it wasn't quite an achsanya, and therefore you can't call it an achsanya. Maybe his didn't have rooms for rent as well. Maybe they only sold liquor. And I suppose to create a word, a bet mashke, he didn't want to. So he says that you write it, bechotzer pliny, whatever the general area is known, hasomuch lir, and whatever is the closest city. And this now, in theory, becomes a source for writing a ksuba. If you're out someplace in a country club or a hotel, a resort hotel, which often is not in an incorporated area, and what in the world are you supposed to write? I would have written b'moloin pliny ha-somuch li'ir. He thinks you leave out, maybe a molon is different than the kretschma of the Aruch HaShulchan. I don't really see why, if there were lodgings in the kretschma as well. And for him, you would just write the Hudson HaSomuch, wherever the city is. There are other cases in which I think there things have happened because nobody, or at least the local rabbis, haven't properly researched the areas. As metropolitan areas grow and incorporate other areas, exactly what happened in New York. You have Brooklyn and Bronx are all part of now what is New York City. You have major metropolitan areas that grow and you incorporate other areas. You can have such a problem in Yerushalayim, the old city, when you've incorporated a couple of Arab villages. And if you have a chasna in one of those villages, is it now Yerushalayim Ir HaKodesh, or is it the name of the Arab village, HaSomuch LYerushalayim? In that case, I wouldn't have any real problem. It's the first time thinking about it. I would write the Arab village HaSomuch LYerushalayim, or maybe even the Arab village without Yerushalayim. And that's only because the Arab village was never muchzak l'ksivas, gitin, and ksubas, to the best of my knowledge. But if you're dealing in a situation in which it was already muchzak and it becomes part of a bigger municipality, it's no longer the name of a shchuna, and the old name should be preserved. Far Rockaway, for example, even the Far Rockaway that's in Queens, is Muchzak Luxivas Gitin from before Far Rockaway was part of Queens. And then it became part of New York. And they continue writing Gitin Far Rockaway. There are also places that have been incorporated, and they were Muchzak, at least Luxivas Ksuba, with whatever name it was. And later, people seem to think that because it's part of a bigger city, that this now becomes nothing more than the name of a shchuna. It may be the name of a shchuna today, but it was once the name of a city, and I see no reason why you shouldn't continue writing the way it was written before. Now, obviously, if this goes on after a while, the old name becomes nishtakach, and people don't really realize that it was the name of the city, and that can only raise additional problems. But in any event, the principle is simple. Where it's muhsak, it's muhsak. Where it's not muhsak, you better do your homework before you decide how you're going to write or spell the area. And there may be some places where it's really problematic, and you've got to write whatever it is that you're writing, and using the city as the simen, as an indicator. Now, as I said a moment ago, the Shem HaMedina we do not write. If you were to have asked me a couple of years ago why we don't write the Shem HaMedina, I would have to shrug my shoulders and say, I don't really have a source. I just know that all the places can say you don't write the Shem HaMedina. Now, since I published in Sivus Halacha, I can quote myself. I think we don't write the Shem HaMedina for a very simple reason. The name of a city doesn't change because it becomes muhsak among Jews as whatever the city is. And Baruch Hashem, we get married. And not Baruch Hashem, we also have divorces. And the name's not going to be forgotten. The cycle of ksubis, if nothing else, is going to preserve the name. However, if I ask you about certain cities, where is Munkacs? Really? Munkacs isn't Hungary anymore.
Right.
Munkacs is, what is it, Ukraine? I don't know which of the Soviet republics. It's part of what was once the USSR. As of World War II, Munkacs was once Hungary. It's not Hungary anymore. So what are you supposed to write? Munkacs is b'medinas Hogar. It's no longer b'medinas Hogar. And this leads only to confusion. That's why you don't write the Shem HaMedina. To me, it's, you know, it sounds like a Dover Poshet. And if you do write the Shem HaMedina and you get it right, it won't pass Luxuba. However, not Brooklyn, New York, as I said before, but Brooklyn, the Medinas, New York. Yes?
But the Medina in the United States is not...
In the state.
But it's not really the
same. No, it's not. You shouldn't write it in the first place. Well, remember, we live in a federal republic.
Right.
Every state is sovereign. Even for purpose of halacha, it would have that status of Medina. There are people who will tell you, and they are probably right, that if you need mayor abonim from three Medinas, three states count. That's because they know the political science. They won't tell you that, I don't know, three Canadian provinces have the same, at least they shouldn't tell you that three Canadian provinces are the same, but there's a good case to be made for, you know, three American states. But you don't write the Medina. There's no reason for it. And kol ha-meisiv gereya, you only create problems when you do things that are superfluous. It's not even a chumra, it's simply plain people don't know. You will also, if you take out any standard ksuba, I don't know if I have a standard ksuba in this book, in the booklet. I shouldn't. There's only one reason to have it there, to show you what not to write. You probably have what is the art scroll ksuba, which is a, is it? Is it here? I think that's what it is. The art scroll, yes, you can see from the English, you've got the art scroll, so then you have another one. That of course does not have the phrase Asher b'Amerika Hatzefonis. If you look, let's see, Beis Medrash Shem Ve'Ever, what page is it? If you tell me quickly. Page 150, is that it? On page 150, on page 1, yes. Oh yes, it did have no Amon, but it happens to be on the same page as New York. You will have New York, and you will see that with regard to New York, and we'll talk in a moment about how you spell New York in our day, but he says, the tshuva of the Beis Yitzchok, there was a get that was sent from New York to, who was in Lemberg? Nev York, Nun Ayin Vov Yud, Yud Aleph Reish Kof, Dimiskarya Noy York. One word, Nun Vov Yud Aleph Reish Kof. He has another one that comes from America, Nay York, with two Yuds and an Aleph, and Yud Aleph Reish Kof, Dimiskarya New York. And he explains why this is all. And there's another place he has one that had Nev York. Now, the principle with regard to Gittin, which isn't your problem, is that you spell names the way they are pronounced where the get is delivered, not where it's written. Forget about how you pronounce it in this city, but in Europe, they didn't call it New York. In Hungary and in Austria, they called it Nev York. I knew a Jew who came to this country after the war, and he was the cook in Mansi, in the yeshiva, and he always talked about going to Nev York. This was Nev York to him, not New York. And apparently in Galicia, they called it New York, or whatever else they called it. And then you have the ultimate spelling, Nun Vov Aleph, Yud Aleph, Resh Kuf. That's how it was Muchzak for Ksivas, Gittin, and Kiddushin. Now, the note that it's spelled with, it's written as two letters, and the space between them should be Mol Isketano, which is the space of a half letter. Not more than that, and again, for your purposes, should be written on the same line, not on two separate lines, since it's really one word, but it's made of two separate components. It has to be on one line, as is again the case with names like Ben Sion and Bas Sheva. You have a Moli Isktana in between, but be careful to write them on a single line. So here you've got the reference to New York, but you also have, well, you have two problems. Number one, how should New York be spelled? If I never saw a get in my life, never saw ksuba in my life, and I was called upon to write New York, how should I write it? Sorry? Nun Yudvav. Why Nun Yudvav? Because if you speak English properly, the name of the city is not New York, nor is Houston Street. Houston Street is Houston Street. The man's name was Houston, and they have a city in Texas named after him. Only in New York they can't speak English, so they call it Houston Street. The EW sound, when properly pronounced by those who speak English, is pronounced New York, not New York. Nevertheless, if I were for the first time writing a get or a ksuba, I would spell it Nun Vov Aleph. And that's for a very, very simple reason. There aren't very many Jews who speak proper English in the city. There aren't very many non-Jews in the city who speak proper English. And that's how they pronounce it. And the fact that the rules say it should be pronounced new make absolutely no difference if they are bolderizing the language and pronouncing it new. So that part they got right. Now comes the other little point. Here, this gentleman reports that he found the get in which it said, where is it, if I can find it here? Asher b'America ha-tzifonis. And he says that his date's from 1852. Hinig harav Reb Avram Yosef Ash. He was not a Rav. He was the first rabbis in America a little bit after that. And he wrote it Kan Binay Yor, two yuds and an aleph. Mosad Yasok if Yomova Nar Hotzen Asher be America Hatzafinis. He should never have written America with an Aleph, but I won't even quibble about that. He is referred to in the Shem Ritzin Hanemon, and I'm almost certain that the author of the article was the editor, who is none less than Bianca Ettlinger, who refers to this gentleman, Meir Echod. America, Sheinu Yudea, B'tiv, Gittin, V'Gidushin. I mean, that's where it all comes from. There's no reason whatsoever to write the name of the continent shared by America and Sylvanians. I don't know what bizarre idea led him to do whatever it is that he does. However, until relatively recently, which means the last 30 years or so, but until relatively recently, if you went into a sewing store and bought a text of Ksuba, you will find Ba'amerika Tzvainis in virtually every text that was being sold in the sewing stores. Again, whatever it means, it means. You can, if you ever sit at Gittin, you can tell a great deal about rabbis. You look at the Ksuba. Sometimes they contain such terrible mistakes that you know exactly what the fellow's credentials were, including one case. I will not tell you the name of the Masada Kedushin. He spelled Psul Tador with a Samach instead of a Tav. I was sitting at the get with Rav Henkin, and I drew his attention to the Ksuba, and Merev Tzitkosai, he said he sure was the Shamus who wrote the Ksuba, not the Rav. I didn't enlighten him. I knew the Shamus in that shul. The Shamus was the Talmud Chochom. The rabbi wasn't. But in any event, you listen to or you hear a Ksuba, that's how you can separate the men from the boys. Not necessarily things that passel, but things that people who know what they're doing don't do, and people who don't know what they're doing do. So we now deal with the various ways to write the city in the Ksuba, and yes, or al kolono, the most important thing is to get the transliteration correct if you're going to have to transliterate in a place which isn't muhsak. Now again, I caution you, the first thing to do if you're in the new shtela is to find out whether it is muhsak, and you will discover rapidly that it was probably incorrectly muhsak, but too bad, you have to live with it. For example, buffalo is written with two pays. It shouldn't be, it should only have one pay. We don't have double consonants mimicking the vernacular, but whoever did it, and I have no idea who did it, it was done, and that's how it remains. Now, let me just make a few general statements. I don't know how much time we're going to have to continue into the nitty-gritty, but you must, if you know nothing else, you must learn how to transliterate, and I've given you Rav Henkin's kuntres, even the names that he gives you. He himself tells you that this is not you in stone, it's not cast in concrete. This is the time of year of Matan Torah. The transliteration is not Halacha Meshani Sinai. It depends upon how it is pronounced. And things change over a period of time. Assuming that Rav Henkin, who is not a native English speaker, got it right the first time. But that's besides the point. I'm not going to now enter into quibbles over individual names. Later, as we go along, I'll show you one or two that are significant. But you must know how to transliterate, number one, for purposes of transliterating the Shambuyir. Number two, if against my advice you insist on writing the Shem Mishpoche, you better spell it correctly. I see no reason to write the Shem Mishpoch. I'll talk about that a little bit later. And again, everybody who looks for a Chumra ends up with things that can pass the Ksuba. You'll write the Shem HaKsuba, and you'll misspell it, and you've passed the Ksuba. I was once present where I had to, though I usually try to stay as far away as possible, but the family's name was Suchet in French, spelled Shin Vov Ches Tes, because Suchet is the French for Sheikhet or Suchet, whatever. Suchet, that's how they pronounced it. And the rabbi performing the ceremony proceeded to write L'mishpachas Sheikhet. Now, it was not L'mishpachas Sheikhet. That's where the name may have come from, but the name Suchet and the name Sheikhet are two entirely different names. Now, that's because he made a real Shinui Hashem. That wasn't the transliteration, because he thought that he was a Chochom and knows enough French to know that Suchet is the French transliteration of Sheikhet. But if you try to to write a any English name in transliteration, it's very easy to make mistakes. Not every mistake will puzzle, some mistakes will. And therefore, what in the world do you need the Tzorah for? Now, I know very well there's a certain rabbinic organization that publishes a text and that it has the Shem HaMishpacha. I have never used one in my life and will not use it. The reason for putting it in, I'll talk about a little bit later when we talk about the Shemus, or I may as well say it now. The reason that they put it in the first place is in case there are two Yosef ben Shimon who are Muchzak in the same city. And if you have two Yosef ben Shimon who are Muchzak, so you have to have some other point of identification. Now, there's a simple form of identification. Write the grandfather's name if you need something more than that. In Gittin, you don't usually have a problem because you write all the kinuyim, you write all the other things. You want to, you want, if you're dealing with a case in which you have two Yosef and Shimon, it's almost, in 90% of the cases, the person has two names. He's Eidel Teru with both of them, but nobody calls him by both names, so you write the Miskeri, and it's very unlikely that the other Yosef and Shimon is also the same combination. You want write the Shem Laz if you know how to spell it, but that you can at least look up in the in Rav Henkin or some other compendia. The family names is harder to look up. The use of a family name is one way to accomplish the same thing, but it's not necessary unless there's Muchzak Shnei Yosef ben Shimon. And even in this great city of New York, I'm not really aware of two people who are Muchzak in the same name. I'm sure there are, but unless they're Muchzak as two Yosef ben Shimon, you're under no obligation to be cheshish for it and no obligation to worry about it. The next case, the final type of situation in which you need to write to be bucky in transliteration is where there is no Shem Kodesh at all. Now, this is a problem. I told you before, Rav Moshe strongly advises against being machzik in name because of Kala v'chameisa, for whatever reason. But there are other situations, and this is pretty typical. The situation happened all the time and still happens. Kid goes to Talmud Torah, and they ask the girl, what is her name? And she says, my name is Cheryl. But you're in Talmud Torah now, or even better, you're in day school where we teach Ivrit Bivrit, and you got to have a Hebrew name. So the teacher proceeds to assign, Cheryl must be Sora. This girl never, her father never threw a kiddush when she was born. He never had an aliyah in which he made her a Mishaberach. And now suddenly you're giving her a name, Sora. I wouldn't be concerned so much if from that day on and forevermore, everybody, not just her teacher, but all her playmates and her parents, called her Sara, and she marries a fine Ben Torah who also calls his Kala Sara, and she's Muchzak as Sara. Her passport still says Cheryl, and it may present a problem when you write it in Get, but if you wrote Sara and Iksuba, you wrote it in the Get with nothing else, it's certainly kosher. Whereas Lachatchila, B'dievet, but kosher it is. But what's going to happen is that this young girl is going to leave Talmud Torah, or maybe she'll study to the 8th grade. The teacher called her Sora formally in class. Her parents never called her Sora. Her friends don't call her Sora. Her chosen doesn't call her Sora. And suddenly when the rabbi asks her, what's your Hebrew name? She says, my Hebrew name is Sora. Don't buy it at face value. The next question is, and how do you know that your Hebrew name is Sora? If she says, because my father went to shul the Shabbos after I was born, and he made a Mishaberach, and said, V'kari Shema B'Yisrael Sora, fine, wonderful, particularly if he kept on going to shul and kept on making her Mishaberachs. But if you get anything less than that, you have a problem on your hand. So why in the world create the problem? this woman's name was Cheryl, and there was no reason for anybody to give her the name Sorrel, so that the Masader Kiddushin, and heaven forfend, the Masader Aget, should have to spend nights resolving the problem of how he's going to be Masader the Ksuber, Masader the Get. There's just no reason for it. There was a one of the Bali Hatesis whose name was Rabbeinu Peter. Now, that's not a name for a nice Jewish boy. Cheryl is a much better name for a nice Jewish girl than Peter for a nice Jewish boy. And Rabbeinu Peter never found it necessary to change his name. The Bali Hatesis referred to him as Rabbeinu Peter. The teacher in the second grade isn't mechuyev to be frumer than the Bali Hatesis. What in the world do you need the name for? Now, once you have the name, you may be stuck with it, because they may be dealing with a case in which there never was a Shem Arisa, and she suddenly shows up, and my name, the only name that I ever had was Cheryl, or who knows what. You've got no choice but to write the name Cheryl. There are other cases when there is a Shem Arisa. It's late, I'll try to make this fast. There are cases, this is one of the points between, I don't know what terms to use. It's not chassidim misnagdim. It's European rabbonim and American rabbonim for the most part. Very often, what happens is that a person is given a name at the bris. If you're lucky, they use it again at the bar mitzvah. And now for the third time in his life, he's using it because you're writing the ksuba. In between, doesn't know what the name is. He even had to go ask his father, what name did they use at the bar mitzvah? Now, the practice, the common practice among, I don't know what to call them, American rabbonim, Litvisher rabbonim, would be to write the Shem Harisa, the Shem Kodesh, and no more. In a get, you write all the names. You write the Shem Harisa first. And that's because of the Aruch Lener and the Olei Shem. It was mukubal in all of these circles that the Shem Kodesh was given for what the Aruch Lener calls Dvarim Shebekedusha. And not that it gets Dvarim Shebekedusha, but it was given for ritual purposes, and this, the fact that you don't use it for other, on other occasions, doesn't mean that it's nishtakach. It's not forgotten. A name that's nishtakach doesn't exist. Among what I call the chassidishe, they are very quick to claim that this kind of name is nishtakach, and they will omit it even from a get. Now, chas v'sholom, the get's kosher. But they are very quick to omit, and certainly in the ksuba they would omit it. I once had the occasion of a zivug sheni, in which the gentleman had a get from his first wife, and the Masader Kiddushin was a Rav Muvok, and he shows me the Petur, and the name was Arthur, and I ask him, and what was the Shem Arisa? In effect, what name did you get at your bris? He said that my name was Yaakov. And I knew already not to ask further. I knew that the Masader HaGet, knowing who he was, he considered to be Mishtakach. Am I going to argue with him? He says that the get this man used only at the Bar Mitzvah, presumably in the first Ksuba, if he had produced it, I'm sure the first Ksuba would have said Yaakov as well. He considered to be Mishtakach. I proceeded to write Yaakov in the Ksuba, not Arthur. Now, in my defense, I will say that I had the benefit, this man, I can't call him Balchuva, but he married a woman from a different kind of a background, and they sent out invitations without consulting me, obviously, in which there was a Hebrew and an English. And on the Hebrew side, it said Yaakov, all of a sudden. Now, I can't call that Nishtakach by anybody's book if he's sending out wedding invitations with the name Yaakov rather than the name Arthur. But those are the cases in which the problem arises. You've got to decide which name you're going to use. And when in doubt, I emphasize, when in doubt, forget the Shem Kodesh, the Shem Arisa. Use the vernacular, the English. but please learn how to transliterate. I will, I won't get beyond this today, but one little story, one of these war stories, I will never forget my first chuppah. I tell the story every year. I was learning in Kailul, keeping body and soul together in part by weekend shtele in some place in New Jersey, and I have my first wedding. I had enough trouble with that wedding. All kinds of trouble with that wedding. The couple come, and after all, you have to ask them their names. So I ask them their names, and I'm told the Hebrew name of the Kala, the Hebrew name of the Chosen, and we come to the Chuppah, and I again ask them again their names, and I proceed to write Iksuba. I write Iksuba. And before I let the Edim sign, there was a grandmother there. She was probably then in her high 80s. And they were sitting around the same table. No separate seating. I turned to her, and I asked, "Vi heist ar enikol af yidish nomen?" And she tells me, "Enikol heis Shleima." And there's an aunt from the other side who may have been a few years younger, but not very few years younger, and says, "Well, say Shleima, hey Shimon, noch mein Elter Zayde," who knows what. And the grandmother starts screaming, says, "Well, say Shimon, hey Shmuel, noch mein Tate." And the women are ready to start pulling each other's hair out. Now, what am I supposed to do here? Nobody else has an inkling. These two elderly women are fighting over what name they gave to the bris. The father couldn't remember, wouldn't know anything. And if he did, I wouldn't have trusted him if he did tell me. So I took out a second ksuba, and I start, his name, English name was Stephen. And he pronounced it Stephen, and he spelled it S-T-E-P-H-E-N. You've got to know, fortunately I knew, without benefit of this course, I knew you go according to the pronunciation, not to the spelling, so I decided to spell it Stephen. But this is my first chuppah. I'm more nervous than this kid is. And I proceed to mess it up. The second, so I don't have a ksuba. I only brought an extra one. So I had to start laboriously spelling out the words of the ksuba, including the name. This was a chasana in which everybody was angry at me. They were angry because it was in a catering hall, and the caterer had rabbinic supervision, but was the kind of supervision that you can bring in whatever you want as long as there's rabbinical supervision. The father of the chosen was a local baker who had no hashgacha whatsoever, and he wanted to bake the wedding cake and had to have a hashgacha. I should give him a piece of paper saying that the cake is kosher. I tell him, "I'm going to give you a piece of paper, you don't have any hashgacha. Hey, I should come in, I should kasher the place, do whatever I want, and I should stand there, and he'll pay me for it, and I should then certify that this cake is kosher." And I look at him, I say, "And then you'll say that your whole bakery is kosher, because I gave a hashgacha to the cake." I said, "In those circumstances." They were, they're extremely angry, to say the least. I was writing the ksuba, and the president was the old-time shul president. They don't exist anymore. His name was Sharloff. I'll never remember. We'll forget his name. He's a Yiddish-speaking gentleman. English was the second language. And he comes over, and he says, "Rebbe, what's to do? What should I do?" So I explained to him that I had to rewrite the ksuba because they can't agree on what the name was, and they don't know what the Hebrew name is. So he says, "Devos v'teshreiben." So I tell him I'm writing the English name, Stephen. He says, follow-up question, he wasn't a fool. So then what are you going to read when you read the ksuba? Tell him, I'll read what's here. Rebbe, as a reform rabbi. So I tell him, halavai, Mr. Charlo, halavai. Anyway, we'll continue next time.